sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Citizens.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expression, expression, expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
progress,
culture,
human rights,
Carter Dana,
solidarity.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good day to our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a global collection of musicians. I'm Jim Hutchings, and I'm joined today by my co-host Gord Barnes. This week, we're talking with Jason Bird about the Idle No More movement, and we'll talk about how it started and what the goals are. Jason is the Aboriginal Support Coordinator for the nursing program at U of R, and maybe we'll prevail upon him to tell us a little bit more about how he got there and all the rest of it. But let's start off with a note from news, actually, from Amnesty International. If you have a look at the Amnesty International website, you often get updates on various issues, and we have one. This is actually dated January 4th of this year, titled Canada, Indigenous Protest Movement Highlights Deep-Rooted Injustices. And it goes thusly: for nearly a month now, an Indigenous leader has been camped out in a traditional teepee near the Canadian Parliament buildings in Ottawa, where she's engaged in a hunger strike aimed at getting a meeting with Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Chief Teresa Spence of the Attawapiskat First Nation started the fast on the 11th of December 2012 to draw attention to an endemic housing crisis in her community and new legislation that undermines the rights of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples across Canada. At the same time, a growing grassroots movement, Idle No More, has successfully used social media to organize demonstrations for Indigenous rights in communities across Canada, prompting solidarity actions around the world. Like Chief Spence's hunger strike, the Idle No More protests are a response both to the government's current legislative agenda and to the long-standing discrimination and injustices faced by Indigenous peoples in Canada, including the failure to uphold negotiated treaties. The spirit and intent of the treaty agreements meant that First Nations peoples would share the land but retain their inherent rights to lands and resources, and instead, First Nations have experienced a history of colonization which has resulted in outstanding land claims, lack of resources, and unequal funding for services such as education and housing. The Idle No More Manifesto states, that was a quotation, Amnesty International and other human rights organizations are supporting the call for indigenous peoples to be full participants in any decisions affecting their rights, including the adoption of new legislation. Idle No More and the actions of Chief Theresa Spence have rightly put the spotlight on Canada's federal policy and legislative agendas that are trampling the inherent rights of indigenous peoples affirmed in domestic and international law. And that's a quote from Susan Lee, Amnesty International's America's Program Director. It's high time for Canada to scrap discriminatory approaches dating back to colonial times and begin to respect the rights of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples under Canadian and international law. Well, that's a good starting point. Welcome, Gord. Welcome, Jason. We're really glad to have you here this morning.
Thank you. So, Jason, welcome to the program. And I thought it would be worthwhile at the very beginning to give you an opportunity to share with our listeners a little bit more about yourself and in terms of what you do, and also maybe if you want to tie that and connect it to the involvement you've had with the Idle No More movement, if you'd like to take some time to do that, that'd be great as well.
Sure. I'll give it kind of I'd like to thank Shauna Uchu and the Treaty 4 Grassroots Movement and their board for allowing me to be a spokesperson today, and also the rest of the Idle No More movement within Regina for allowing me to be a spokesperson as well. Kind of honored to do that today. My role with Idle No More in of itself and how I got involved is I just started reading the stuff that was written, the Bill C-45 thing in middle November, late November is when I caught it. December 10th, I started hearing about movement to do, I don't know, different things across the country there that were peaceful protests, and I really liked that aspect of it. So there was the flash mob and that stuff. How I got involved was mainly through social media, actually. That's how I got picked up. And next thing you know, I started reading every article, report that was being thrown out there, every single thing that was happening across the country and even now globally at this point. And I just wanted to be a part of the movement, so I just kind of started attending rallies, started promoting Idle No More as much as I could personally, joined their group, joined their Facebook page, started reading their website, just got as involved as I could and started reading everything I could concerning the movement and where they're trying to head.
That's wonderful. So, you know, that one of the exciting things is that how quickly things have evolved, if I can put it that way. I was recalling back mid-November, I believe it was November 15th on a Thursday evening at the First Nations University. Amnesty was honored to be part of an event where one of the leaders of the Idle No More movement came to Regina and spoke, Sylvia McAdam. And then 2 days later on the Saturday, there was a forum at the First Nations University as well. But, you know, that's not all that long ago in the scheme of things, and there's been a lot of things that have happened. And you've participated in some of them, I guess, some of the round dances that have happened in Regina?
I have, and in some of the walks that have happened as well. Most of them in December, and then into early January, when I could have time. You know, I work as well, so some of these things get held during the day, and you can't make it, right?
Right.
So it's tough to get to everything, but the ones that I can get to, I do get to.
Right. I recall on that cold winter day of December 26th being able to participate. It's one of the ones I was able to get to personally, where there was a round dance at the Cornwall Center, and a lot of people there. Just amazing, the number. I don't know if you were able to participate in that one, Jason.
Saw the video.
Okay. It was amazing. It was really quite exciting to see the response and what... If I can just share, I'd like you to kind of offer your thoughts on this too. But that particular one, I was really impressed with the extent to which people who had just come to the mall that day and found out this was happening were supportive of it and excited to see it happen, appreciated the opportunity to hear the round dance music. And that's the kind of response I've been picking up. I mean, there are some, obviously, at times, some less than positive responses. But I think generally, when there have been events, there's been the people who are actually there and attending have been really appreciated. But I'd really like you to, you know, share your own perspective and experiences as well.
I've been in one of the flash mobs at the U of R. There was one. I was part of that one, and I was part of another one through... Treaty 4 Grassroots Movement, Idle No More. For me, what I really like about them personally is it's an extent of identity, right? First Nations people, kind of their identity has kind of been told what they're going to be, whether that's federally, provincially, just in this whole country. And when you see something like that spring up, and just the joy of it, and the peacefulness of it, and the kind of the cooperation that was happening, to me, I was really impressed with the sharing of the culture and saying, everybody's welcome. You know, this isn't just our culture. You're welcome to dance with us as well. Because that's what the round dance is really about. It's a unity dance.
Right.
And I really, to me, to see that and all the voices of the Aboriginal people singing and sharing our culture, and it's a wonderful culture.
Yeah.
All the people that I had that were going and that I'd seen along the way, everyone was really proud that that is happening. If you watch the videos in Saskatoon or Edmonton as well, huge, huge flash mobs. I mean, we're talking 2,000 people plus.
Yeah.
And it's hard not to be, as an Aboriginal person who's had their identity kind of defined for them for so long, to see you defining your own publicly. Mm-hmm. Something about that just springs life in you.
Yeah. That's the sense of the one particular one that I was able to attend. And when you, as you say, when you watch the videos, I mean, I saw one that was held in Minneapolis in the Mall of America, and there was a large number of people there because it's a big mall, obviously, but and has got the space for it. And it's interesting in that respect, the extent to which this has become an international movement.
Yeah, it's becoming global. We have no support from New Zealand now, South America. We're talking London, Germany. You can go across this globe, lots of places in America. And a lot of the indigenous people and non-indigenous want to be involved, because you look at stuff like Occupy and that movement as well. There was already frustration growing within, especially towards the conservative right. Unfortunately, that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the rights seem to be kind of more loosened, right, and less regulations and stuff of that nature. A lot of people are really upset with that kind of stuff, or being kind of not being consulted prior on legislation being passed, apparently for their benefit, which it really isn't. I think globally, that's kind of what people are flocking towards. Same thing with the peacefulness of it. It's King Jr.-esque in a way when you look at how it is, right? None of us support violence. We want everything to be nonviolent, cooperative as much and as far as we can do this.
Yeah.
And that globally, it rings with people.
Right.
They enjoy that. I mean, how can you get an Idle More movement in Germany?
Yeah.
You know, unless they really see that cooperation.
Yeah. You were saying earlier that one of the things that really attracted you to the Idle No More movement is the human rights aspect of it, Jason. And, you know, on this program, we've on other occasions had people as guests who have talked about human rights and the relationship of that to respect for treaty rights. And do you want to just kind of share your thoughts in terms of what it is that stands out relative to the focus around human rights and the Idle No More movement?
I think why it's human rights is, if you go back to the history of this and how it gets to today. So if you go from about for Treaty 4 area here, from 1876 forward, you have the Indian Act, legislation passed to determine for Indians who they are, identity-wise, determine for them legislation that's going to affect them and their communities, land, management, you name the whole thing. To this day, that act still exists as it stands in many ways. Even though the Constitution in 82 happened, Section 35 guaranteeing inherent treaty right, you know, inherent sovereignty rights in a sense, for First Nations people to declare for themselves what's best for them. None of that stuff was ever really followed through on. So you have the situation now where people are standing up and saying, I want to claim my identity. I would rather that we ran our communities and not have the federal government have a department over us and an act of legislation over us defining the whole bit. Teresa Spence's fast ended yesterday. 13 points came out of it as a pretext to why she was going to end. Those 13 points are not unfair and unreasonable requests.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go and read some of the papers and the comments online, you would be amazed at some of the things people are saying about those requests. But those are the same requests that have always existed for the past 100-plus years for First Nations communities. We're totally admitting now and standing up for it and saying, okay, we can either continue to be silent about this and just let them continue to let Canada define our identity, or we stand up and try to define it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Idle No More is happening.
Mm-hmm.
It is a human rights issue in that sense that the rights of all the Indigenous people across Canada are being defined for them, not by them.
Mm-hmm. One of the observations I've had over the years is that, unfortunately, so many generations of people who are not First Nations people have not had the experience of learning about treaty rights. And way I was taught Canadian history years ago now.
1940s, I believe.
Well, not quite that long ago. But, you know, it really was not a good reflection of Canadian history in terms of what happened. And I'm hoping that that is, in fact, improving. I've had the opportunity to get some experiences where I've visited elementary schools, and young people are learning now about treaty rights. I'm hoping things will be taught appropriately, first of all, about right. treaty rights. But I was there at a elementary school with university students who, you know, are Amnesty International activists, and they found it quite interesting because they knew less about treaty rights than the young people who are in elementary school. And it just shows you that and the young people in elementary school were excited to learn about treaty rights. And so I don't know. Hopefully, things will evolve in a more positive way with generations. But having said that, that's no excuse for me not knowing about them.
yeah, I guess.
and I think that's one of the things that I need to acknowledge.
I think what needs to be known about treaty rights is, I mean, realistically, anybody out there watching this program can go and Google this. You can Google treaties 1 through 11. You can go through the Department of Indian Affairs, AANDC's site, and look at the history of treaties in Canada. There's really no excuse for no one to know now. Mm-hmm. I put this link up online, I don't know, about 300 times now in the past 2 months. But if you look at the real history of treaties in Canada, there was a real cooperation right off the bat. Huge cooperation. If you look at how Canada is actually formed, French, English, and then Canada, and then you have the states. So obviously to protect British land, which is who ended up winning these wars, you know, First Nations people were siding with different communities. In the end, they helped the British. They helped the French as well, which now has Quebec. We helped them stop America from coming into Canada. These are the original treaties that were signed with First Nations people as you go forward until you get to the treaties 1 through 11. So realistically, the process is a matter of respect. Mm-hmm. Now, when people look back, that's what they should be thinking. Mm-hmm. Not that it was a matter of, we're trying to divide your country, we want your stuff, and you owe us this. It's not an owing thing. It's nothing to do with that. It's a matter of respect. Mm-hmm. Saying, okay, when I look back at these nations and I look at how this country was formed, we were integral to the creation of this very country. And we support Canada 100%. Mm-hmm. We want everybody to have the best life here that they can have. Mm-hmm. But we want the best life too. So mm-hmm. that's really the key part.
And I guess one of the difficulties that, you know, people have talked about is through the process of some of the legislation that was passed last year by the federal government, there hasn't been appropriate levels of consultation that with First Nations leadership and communities that then directly impacts them, and that is a significant human rights issue.
Yeah, that's kind of the big one right now around Bill C-45. I just had a chance to read November 19th's Parliament meeting. AFN, the First Nations chiefs from Saskatchewan and Manitoba, mm-hmm. none of them actually wanted that bill to pass. That's mm-hmm. written there. You can go look it online. There was manufactured consent by the government. Mm-hmm. Two groups that were, I guess they're supposed to be Aboriginal-based groups, had represented economic development and taxation. Those two groups were the manufactured consent for the government to push that through. And so if you look at what you see now from the AFN and all these chiefs and why they're angry, they know there was no actual consent. This is what the government, when Duncan came out on January 11th and said, well, we met Section 35 of the Constitution. We also met the duty to consult. I don't know if you would really call, they didn't meet the real duty to consult because they didn't get consent. Mm-hmm. So how can you move forward with something when you're trying to change legislation that affects all of these people with really no consent to do so? Mm-hmm. That's the real big issue here.
Right. And you've talked about the responsibility to consult. One of the things that's clearly outlined in the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We've shared conversations about the Universal Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples on this program before with other guests. And, you know, it's a landmark human rights internationally recognized treaty now, document that has been acknowledged by countries around the world. Canada didn't initially support it, but
there was four
finally
countries,
did.
Right?
That's right, four countries, Canada, United States, Australia, and New Zealand. But finally, people have come on side And I guess, you know, to move forward now, in the absence of appropriate levels of conversation or consultation, flies in the face of that declaration.
Yeah, and that's another thing I always bring up online with people, and I discuss with them to look at current situation. So Amnesty International, the UN, 2006 census, all three of these documents claim and straight out tell you indigenous people are not being treated fairly, not equally in this country at all. And I don't have to show you those documents. You can go online. Anybody listening can go online and take a look at those. They're free for everyone to read. And I say go read them. There's obviously a big issue. Saskatchewan just came out the other day. Brad Wall fumbled through his words to get to this point that the Aboriginal employment numbers in this country, or in this province, they're horrendous. Mm-hmm. He had something from Eric Howe from the U of S that sent him a report saying, if you don't change this now, give it 20 years. And this province will be in some serious economic disparity and trouble as well, because there won't be enough people to work the jobs and all the stuff that they want to, that is of their concern. So Brad Wall is, they know that there's changes that need to occur provincially and federally as well. And we know the benefit for Canada is to make sure that these Indigenous rights are actually more equal to Canadian levels. Mm-hmm. If you do that, the benefits outweigh the negatives in this case.
Mm. That's great. How are we doing for time here, Jim? Are we close to the break now?
We're 5 minutes
away. Okay, thanks. Just a good update. Jason, I wonder if you got sort of information to share about upcoming events that will be held in Regina?
I do. I got a little list here from Shauna Uchu at Treaty 4 Grassroots Movement gave to me, and one held by the local Anne Lamore Movement, January 27th, the Idle Lamore teach-in in Yorkton. And there's a round dance at one of the at the Parkland Mall, I believe, happening around the same time. Great. So if you're out in the Yorkton area and you're hearing this, feel free to come and join that teaching and listen and discuss with people. January 28th, Fort Qu'Appelle Idle Lamore March for Justice Walk, starting at 12 o'clock at noon. Regina has Idle Lamore Day World of Action on the same day, 6 o'clock p.m. at the Connexus Arts Center. And we're bringing out a variety of people. SCAR is going to be there, Choices for Green Saskatchewan and Canada. There's going to be lawyers speaking. And again, these are places where you get to meet and talk to the people that are involved in this movement and have discussions. And Yorkton's having an Idle Lamore March and Rally, 5 o'clock p.m. that same day. So there are a lot of events happening. And these are the only ones down here. Mm-hmm. I haven't even mentioned Saskatoon, whether there's stuff in Prince Albert, LaRonge. You know, there's a variety of places that are also doing other things. I think on that day, if you go online to Idle Lamore's webpage, idlelamore.ca, you can check the events. And there's a variety of them happening all over the place.
So maybe we should just make sure people caught the information with respect to Regina then. Okay. At the Connexus Arts Center?
It's going to be at the Connexus Arts Center on January 28th, which is Monday. Idle Lamore World Day of Action at 6 o'clock p.m. to about 8 o'clock p.m. Wow. And we're going to be discussing a lot of different issues there. But it's a very inclusive setting as well. We're not just looking at Bill C-45 from an Indigenous standpoint, although today we are discussing that. Right. There's also the environmental standpoint that's involved there. And this involves all Canadians, whether they choose to hear this or not. We're Canadian citizens as well, and environmentalism affects your communities. You can be sheltered by a city and not understand what's happening in northern communities or in communities where mining is happening. But you should know. You know, at some point this will come down far enough where it does affect you, and even to the point of climate change right now. It obviously is affecting people.
So the event at the Connexus Arts Center, is it kind of a forum where there's speakers and stuff like that? Is that the idea, or would it be, again, a round dance, or a bit of both? Or
what's going to happen is there's going to be keynote speakers, there's going to be some live entertainment, the Buffalo Lodge singers, Bill Cook, Shannon McNabb, three different Indigenous groups are going to sing as well, so promote some of the culture. Professor Bill Isikanak from the First Nations University is going to do a speech on, I think, on water rights. Larry Qualchuk, a lawyer, is going to come out. Jacqueline Anaquat, a First Nations University student. Aboriginal feminism she's going to discuss. Bob Hughes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good.
Saskatchewan Coalition Against Racism. Good. SCAR. You'll be there. I'm the co-host here. Yeah. Dodie Ferguson, Canadian Union of Postal Workers, going to come out and discuss their involvement. Elizabeth Curry, Coalition for a Clean Green Saskatchewan, going to discuss radioactive and hazardous waste. And then the MC is going to be Mr. Howie Thompson. And this is it's kind of a big, I guess, a session from 6 to 8 o'clock. But again, these are the kind of things where people hang around and talk.
Great. You know, we've had Shannon as a guest on the program, and if people have a chance, I'm sure that's going to be really an interesting evening and very worthwhile in terms of learning and sharing information. So encourage people to get out to that. So again, that's at the Conexus Arts Center on the 28th, right?
Yeah, this Monday coming up.
Super.
And okay. I think it's really worthwhile for the average person to go out there. When I'm talking to people about these issues, there seems to be no lack of misconceptions.
True.
You know? And I think if you haven't really had a good look or studied treaties and what they're all about, so you should make the effort to go to an event like this and listen and ask questions.
Yeah, it's definitely a discussion time, right?
Mm-hmm. And everybody seems to have their preconceived notions about what it's all about, and generally speaking, they're wrong.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I have my preconceived notions about the Conservative Party, but I still would vote Conservative if they had the right platform.
Yeah.
And this isn't a political thing, and I want people to know that this is apolitical in a sense.
Yeah.
In my head, all I want is my identity.
Yeah.
I don't really care if it's Liberal, NDP, or Conservative, yeah. or Green Party.
Yeah.
As long as the discussion can be had, right? So I want people out there to know this isn't about ideology. This is really about rights. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a very simple thing.
That's a great summation of where things are at, and I appreciate the way you've described that, Jason. It's and I think it's important for people to recognize that it's something people actually could come together around.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, everyone can.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we'll take our break now.
Great.
And when we come back, we're going to hear some music from Chester Knight. that was Chester Knight. Now, Chester has got an anthem for the Idle No More movement that just was, I think, released earlier this week, but it's so new, we don't have it.
So maybe we can use that on air in the next couple of weeks once it's available.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Music to share, but that's a good one. Thanks for suggesting that, Jason.
Yeah, thank you.
And so we were talking earlier about the federal legislation, Bill C-45, and there are specific concerns in Bill C-45. It was a large piece of legislation, right, and covered a wide range of topics, I guess, if you can put it that way. But there were some specific things that I know people really were concerned about, First Nations people and around the environment and how it affected potentially the environment and water. But also there were things that were there that there was really concerns about how that could impact on existing treaties and then what it might mean for First Nations in terms of potentially taking some existing land out of the treaty process, and I'm not describing that well, but would you like to kind of share your perspective on that and your understanding of it?
Yeah, I'll speak to that. I know with Bill C-45, there's a piece of that bill, and it's a really small piece, easy to read, concerning changes to the Indian Act.
Right.
Okay, that's one piece, but there's actually more coming down the line as well that most people don't know about 7 or 8 more pieces of legislation dealing with kind of removing indigenous sovereignty or indigenous management. In this case, this is the oldest tactic in the book, this piece here. It gives, basically, that piece actually allows bands to individualize in a sense, which is really strange. Just communal lands, everybody shares it. How they would even individualize something like that is beyond me, but that's the proposal. So they want to individualize. So what could happen is they could run meetings. So if someone wanted to buy that land or purchase that land somehow, or if someone wanted to run a pipeline through that land, let's say, and they wanted to buy or lease that land, they could hold small minority meetings, get a majority in those minority meetings, and pass that resolution in that band. Now, it doesn't take the full majority and consent of everybody on that band to do so. This is an old process that goes back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. This has been tried before. Mm. This is a known process. I come from a band where this happened on Papikasis. Exact same process happened there. Late 1800s, there was maybe 7 different people, different families living in there, and counting Papikasis and others, families that had run that reserve. What happened was the government, the Department of Indian Affairs, ran a program to actually get other families, better farming families, and make a farming community there. So they thought, let's get the best of the best that we can find that are farmers in these local schools, bring in these Indians to this place. What happened is they started having meetings there with the fewest amount of band members they could to vote in these families. And most of the people from the 7 original didn't want that to happen. But they found ways to manufacture consent so that more families could keep getting in. Eventually, after a while, you have enough families transplanted there, they're voting other families in. That's kind of some of the case that happened on that reserve in and of itself. Now, I don't know how many other places this happened, but that's the crazy thing, right? This is the same thing that happened in the early 1900s happening again, and people are like, no, not this time.
And you were saying earlier that with respect to that piece of the larger piece of legislation, really one of the crucial things is there wasn't support or appropriate levels of consultation or consent from the leadership, for example, of the FSAI and here in Saskatchewan, right, the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, or the Assembly of First Nations.
Correct.
Although there's been some suggestions made by some people that they did support it, but that is not the case.
That is not the case. I've read a lot of articles recently in the past 2 weeks, and I've looked into that. I got this article sent from Celia McAdam herself, right, the Parliament one, and I read that through just to see what had actually happened that day. But yeah, there's no way that the AFN is supporting that. Even in that document as far back as November 19th, you see that. And then you see that with the chiefs as well. It does make sense that the Manitoba chiefs are the most angry. When you see them in the news and Nipinak is saying, we'll bring your economy to your knees.
Yeah.
You see that quote. They want the sensationalism of it. But realistically, they never wanted Bill C-45 in the first place. They were that's the group that said, no, we don't want this. And no wonder why they're so vocal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I kind of noticed with that.
Mm-hmm. Do you, you know, there's some people who have suggested that this is a really significant movement relative to young people and age, and yet I'm not sure that's a fair description of it. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is it something that's really primarily being organized by young people who are First Nations, or do you have any?
If you actually look at the four ladies that are running the group, they're all in their late 30s, mid 40s. Yeah, they're young. Well, they wouldn't want me to say that, but there's a lot of youth involved. Of course, there is. I mean, we're one of the youngest populations in Canada. There is going to be a lot of youth involved.
Yeah.
But I've seen grandmas walking. I've seen grandmas form protests within this city.
Yeah.
So I loved what Wob Kanu said on CBC one time. And he mentioned, what would it take for your grandma to get out and protest something?
Yeah.
A 78-year-old lady to get out of the retirement home, or if she's living at home, wherever she is, to actually get out and protest.
Mm-hmm.
What would it actually take to move someone to do that? Now, you have to ask yourself why those people are doing that. Because that's the most intriguing part of this, is that we have a lot of support from older ladies and elders themselves who are like, about time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just primarily a young movement, right across the spectrum. For everybody, and it's not only a non-average movement either, right? We want everybody involved. This is your country.
Mm-hmm.
This is everybody's country, a shared country, in my opinion. So everybody should be involved.
Yeah. And with respect to the older people, you know, I'm sure over the years there's been so many experiences they've had where they have not been able to celebrate their identity, their heritage, and their culture. And for example, they haven't even. I'm sure there's older people within the community that have not even at times been allowed to speak their language. And, you know, and as a result of the residential school experiences people have gone through, it's been very, very difficult. And then now to be able to participate in this movement really at their age must be quite exciting.
I think it would be freeing. And that's the same for everybody across the board. I mean, I'm 37. I was born in 75, grew up in the 80s. I grew up in the poverty on these reserves, locally, an hour away from here. So I know exactly how they look and how they feel. I grew up as the only Indian kid in a school, you know, or one of five in a group of 35. And you really feel outnumbered. You really feel like you can't talk about who you are and what your identity is. So we do it when people don't see us, you know, when we get together and hang out. And that's what all of us were doing until this movement. Yeah. Now, all of a sudden, you know, everybody's coming out and being free about who they are and saying, you know what, this is who I am. Why should I deny that? And I think for those older ladies, having some of the residents, like my parents would have went through residential schools, both of them did, a lot of those old ladies would have had the same experience, and that would have been a lot harder in their time than it was when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's getting easier for kids, especially with a movement like this, to say, it's okay to be me. It's okay to have braids when I'm, you know, 7 years old and I go to school and people don't understand that. Or they call you, oh, you're a girl, and da-da-da-da. But that's part of their culture, right? Some people, that's part of their culture, sign of strength. So I think those things, that's what we're trying to change. We want to reclaim our identity in this country. And we can't do that if we keep on having legislation passed for us or departments deciding for us how our money should be spent. That's just outright crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sense that money coming down from government, and there's, I guess in Indian affairs, there's millions and millions of dollars, and somehow or other it all gets diverted and diluted, so by the time you get down to the actual money spent to the individual person on the reserve, there doesn't seem to be a whole bunch to go around.
Yeah, and that's the big issue. I think there's, I looked at the number today, and I forget how much it's, I think it's in the billions, or in the high millions, the money that actually gets spent and sent through the Department of Indian Affairs for the 631 bands, I think it is, across Canada, or 650. They're not totally sure on the number. It changes every time I read an article. But it seems like that you have to filter all that money out. Attitipwasgat really showed something when you look at the books there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's bad housing. There's just bad infrastructure in general there.
Right.
Water problems. 85% of those houses were in condemnatory condition.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? And then you start looking at the price to build a house there. And you start looking at how you'd have to, you know, literally these chiefs have to write to the Department of Indian Affairs to get the money released to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always done in a timely manner. What happened is they were put in third-party management, I think.
Right.
That slowed the process down even more.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of created condition after condition. continuing to make poverty at the level it was, it's underfunded. I mean, you really look at what they were getting per year, it was $10 million. If you look at what a town or a city gets, or even a municipality in the local area, it's probably quite a bit higher. Whether you look at that's educationally or any employment-wise, any of the areas around them, everything else seems to be, if you compare the conditions, they're not equal.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you touched on education. I mean, right there, there's a totally different standard there.
Right. And I've read reports on that just recently. I just put one up on Facebook showing how inequitable it is. And a report in Manitoba, how Wei Wei's capital wanted to become a regular provincial school.
Mm-hmm.
There was a provincial school close to them within, I don't know, 30 kilometers. And they wanted to have the same rights. They actually, funding and agreement, arrangement-wise, were very different.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that how can someone be 30 kilometers apart from one another and be this inequitable?
Yeah.
So they're trying to work on that problem, but it does exist. And it's just a matter of finding solutions. Like, we're sick of the problems. Let's get some solutions out there that actually do work.
And you wonder sometimes about, well, is the government actually moving in good faith? I'm not saying that they aren't, but right. It makes you wonder sometimes when you have an activist like Cindy Blackstock talking about children's services, and she can demonstrate, she's done the research, and she can demonstrate that on a per capita basis, children, First Nations children, are not getting the same percentage of funding for services as what ordinary Canadian children are getting.
I believe that's a UN report, is that? Or Amnesty International? It's one of the two. Yeah. I just read this report. There's a bunch of them on. If someone wants to Google this, there's tons of them.
Yeah.
You can actually go and find those reports. I was reading some of them today.
But I find it distressing that the government seems to have put more effort into discrediting Cindy. You know, they actually have had.
It was $3 million or something?
I'm not sure what the number is, but they've put a significant amount of money into investigating her to try, I guess, to destroy her credibility rather than deal with the facts as they've been presented.
Yeah, and that's kind of the big problem here, right? Because I think the government wants to say it does work in good faith. But we know, as First Nations people, Indigenous people in this country, they don't. We've been dealing with this for a long time. Mm-hmm. Section 35, 1982, never been solved. They still haven't given us what's promised there. You can go to 1996, Royal Treaty Commission. 440 points were made of changes that could have been done in Canada to improve Indigenous conditions. Very few followed through on. Mm-hmm. 2006, Kelowna Accord, 10 years later from that. Liberals pass it, they leave office, Conservatives bust it. Done. We're not going to follow through on that. It seems to me that every time, the first thing to cut all the time when it comes to anything important in this country is when we have to cut some debt or something, let's cut a First Nations program. Mm-hmm. Secondly, mm-hmm. let's cut an art program. Anything that have to do with those areas seem to get cut quite a bit. Not cool, obviously, because those are some of the best areas that will actually end up changing this country, but they don't want to deal with those problems. And mm-hmm. in the case with Cindy Blackstock, as you mentioned, I read this today, I think it was $3 million used in court cases, or maybe even more than that.
Yeah.
To stop her from going forward. That's kind of a sad reality of what's going on out there. It's easier to hide it than to deal with it.
Shoot the messenger.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the case, right?
And to be fair, you're mentioning that it was a Liberal government that was, that would be in 82. But this has been going on since the very beginning.
Right.
You know, it's not exclusively to any particular political party. Just the Canadian government in general has not done its best job of dealing with the way the treaty should be implemented.
Right, and no one comes up with a good plan. Like, it doesn't matter which party you talk to. Even though two parties supported Theresa Spence's 13 points, it's kind of like, well, okay, that's cool. Now, how would you back that plan?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you can agree to 13 points, have fun, but unless you actually come up with a solid plan, what I'd call for is researchers out there in the Indigenous community or non-Indigenous community develop a plan to change the way Canada deals with Indigenous people. That has to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Enough of this Department of Indian Affairs, enough of John Duncan and that position, and enough of being managed by, you know, the government. The biggest complaints out there right now from Taxpayers Union, which I've read, and other people in that regards, is mismanagement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how can a BAM be mismanaging funds they don't even control? Mm-hmm. That's the strange and crazy thing.
Right.
If you give them full control, we'll take full blame.
Mm-hmm.
But until you give those bands full control of their own money and their own way to spend it and their own time on that resources, then how can they even be closely considerably blamed for all the problems occurring and the poverty occurring and the housing and a lot of the incarceration problems and justice problems? it's hard to even know where to start with those problems, but I know where to start. Change the system. That's where you start. You can't go small and try to change one little thing at a time. But again, I'm proposing something that may never happen.
You know, we were just, you're referring to Cindy Blackstock, and it's probably worth noting that, you know, as the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, their organization in 2007 filed a human rights complaint with the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. And the federal government has actively tried to discourage and oppose that. The complaint has been supported by other organizations, including Amnesty International. Essentially, what it is a complaint around the funding levels for, as you were saying, Jim, the low funding levels for child welfare services across Canada for First Nations communities. And even though it was filed in 2007, there's been a real significant level of stonewalling. Things are moving forward this spring, and then even in the next month or two around that, it'll be back before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. But also, just to note that on February 14th, the second annual Have a Heart campaign, and it's an initiative of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. Amnesty International members across Canada are going to be supporting that campaign. And it's essentially a process where we're encouraging people to send a Valentine to their member of parliament or to the prime minister saying have a heart and support appropriate levels of funding for child and welfare services for First Nations communities across Canada. So I wanted to just mention that because it's coming up fairly soon.
I actually read that yesterday. That whole thing.
And probably with your, you know, your work now, you were saying at the beginning of the program, Jason, that you're working at the University of Regina and you're involved in student recruitment, if I understand it correctly.
No, and I'm work for the Faculty of Nursing as a Aboriginal Support Coordinator.
Okay. So in terms of your
started there, though, at student recruitment.
Student recruitment initially. Probably with your involvement there at the university, you're connecting with many people who have got experiences where, you know, that this is pretty close to the kinds of reasons now they're coming to nursing is what I was thinking. Is it the people who are coming forward and wanting to be involved in as First Nations people in nursing program, it must be a really interesting area of work for you.
It is. Nursing is one of the slower growing one for the Aboriginal population. We're meeting half of our numbers in the 2 years we've existed. The reason is, though, is the education levels on most reserves. They can't. We need Chem 30, Chem 20. Mm-hmm. Chemistry, there's no chemistry teachers on First Nations bands. That's usually the case.
Really?
Right. So sciences and maths, if you're wondering why First Nations are struggling in sciences and maths, those are some of the least hired teachers out in First Nations communities just because they're harder to find one. And most people don't want to work in some of these more isolated communities. So it's hard for us to recruit people to get into the program. We get the ones that want to be there for the reasons exactly that you're naming, because they're really concerned. They want to help the community. That's what they've seen a lot of poverty and that kind of stuff growing up. They want to be part of the solution. Same thing, if you actually look at the numbers at the University of Regina where Aboriginal students do go, education, social work, very few go to business, engineering, and those areas. But education and social work are two of the biggest, social work being the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to wonder why that's exactly the case. They know what they want to change.
Yeah, yeah. But you're saying that a significant barrier then for growing the nursing population in terms of First Nations students really is rooted back in terms of the inability to recruit students teachers for a critical part of that program for entrance.
When I was a student recruiter, same thing. I've been doing this for 8 years at the university now. I started as a recruiter when I was going to a lot of those local communities where those band schools were. They're not funded very well. And you'd have to go out and see it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you go take a look at some of these schools and you just see the amount of funding they have, the lack of programs, lack of services. It's hard to know when to spend the money on a teacher for Chem 30. How do you justify that when there's so many other needs? How can you say, okay, that's what we need this year? How can you sustain that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the real big question for many of these bands. And the education inequalities, they exist because there's underfunding actually happening. So it's really hard to determine, right? Because what I've noticed with a lot of First Nations bands in general, and I don't know if this is the Department of Indian Affairs plan or if this was always their thing that they were working on, but is to keep them in a poverty level. Mm-hmm. They're consistently at a poverty level. How can you be worrying about education when your people are worrying about eating? Like, that's a really tough thing. So if you look at education numbers across this province, they're way lower. They're actually dropping. That's actually the case. They're not getting better. Employment numbers are getting worse. Mm-hmm. These are actually the case for a government that's so progressive and so wonderful. Mm-hmm. How can things be getting worse in this province for a certain group of people and not for others?
Yeah.
That's really strange.
There's a very discouraging statistic that says that an Aboriginal male has a better chance of going to prison than he does of completing high school.
Right, and that's, if you do look at the statistics, that's pretty much true.
Yeah, that's pretty sad.
So, and again, those are the conditions. If we can eradicate mm-hmm. poverty in the First Nations, indigenous communities in this country, you imagine the changes that would happen. One of them mm-hmm. would be that would change
that
significantly.
It has to change.
I mean, anytime you see poverty anywhere in the world, one of the very first things you see from poverty, crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason crime exists is because mm-hmm. you've got to eat. You've got to live somehow.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't get a job and you can't get out there and do the things that everyone else has, you know, accessibility to do, you got to find a way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, this is why people are joining gangs left and right in the First Nations community, inner cities. Where do you go? Where do you turn when there's no help?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? That's why I'm glad a movement like Idlemore exists, because how do you combat that kind of stuff unless your community is willing to stand up and say, look at us, we're standing up for our identity now. Mm-hmm. Join us. Get out of that. Come and join us and be part of this now. And that's what's always needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we understand to deal with the conditions in this country, you got to deal with poverty. And if you don't deal with the poverty conditions, this will always continue.
Mm-hmm.
We'll always be fighting for identity.
So do you sense that in terms of the young people who are going to school, First Nations people in the cities, say Regina and Saskatoon, that in terms of the kind of education opportunities they're getting, how would you describe that relative to people who are not First Nations students in Regina and Saskatoon? I know there's been a little bit of stuff in the news and even the last week about that in relative to Regina, about concerns that really the quality of the education opportunities for First Nations students in our cities is not as good.
And that could be the case. So we're talking about high school
yeah,
in that area?
Yeah.
I think they're really trying. Like, I can't knock the public and Catholic schools in the cities. Myself personally,
okay.
The truth is the province does not fund First Nations students. That's just the way it works. I mean,
right.
that's part of the equation. So the money comes from the federal government. That money is actually less per student, per Aboriginal student, as it is per non-Aboriginal student. That's just the way it works.
Right.
So they're getting less money, right,
right,
in those school systems because of that very case. I don't know if there's an intention or anything like that going on in those school systems. I think they're really trying their best.
Okay.
But if those Aboriginal students don't feel like they fit in these communities, I mean, and their identity, I mean, you have to imagine some of these kids they want to deny their identity, never mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, any of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
How do you really plan to succeed if you live in kind of a dual world?
Mm-hmm.
I grew up that same, I went to O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in the hood,
mm-hmm.
and I used to walk to school, and I literally would, it was literally like walk from one neighborhood to a whole, like from one city to a whole nother city,
mm-hmm.
it seemed like to me. And the way people were treated at that school were quite different. Everything there, I learned a lot when I was at O'Neill because of that. Just seeing the differences. But I'd be going back to my community, which was very, it was in poverty. You know,
mm-hmm.
like that's just the way it works in the inner city. You go back to that and you see the crumbling, you know, the condition of that. And then you go and you see this and everybody's so hopeful. And it's hard to rectify both. And then you go back to your community and everybody's dropping out.
Yeah.
Well, what do? You drop out with them. Because
yeah.
you don't know where that's your support system. Unfortunately, that seemed to be the case when I was growing up. It probably somewhat still is the case.
Yeah. So, you know, just in terms of The observation I would have in terms of the Idle No More movement is that it is an exciting opportunity for everybody. And the way you've described it, Jason, is, I think, like that in the sense that because you've talked about the significance of people getting excited about the opportunity to reclaim your identity. And I'd like to thank you for being on the program. Have you got some other things? Maybe you could share that again, because we did... At the beginning of the, or the end of the first half of the program, you shared the upcoming events. Do you want to just run through that real quick?
Yeah, I'll go through really quick. I just like to let everybody know, and Idlemore is for everyone. Even though I'm talking about a lot of Indigenous rights here, these concern everyone. So let's all get involved. There's environmentalism as well. January 27th in Yorkton, Idle No More Teaching, Round Dance. The 28th in Regina, Connexus Arts Center, International World Day of Action, 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Come out and hear our speakers. Fort Qu'Appelle has something at noon, and Yorkton has something at 5 o'clock.
Super. Thanks so much for being on the program today, Jason. It was really a great conversation. And
Thanks very much. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m., Amnesty letter writing at Atlantis Coffee happens. That's at Victoria and Hamilton Street. Several Amnesty members will be present writing current Amnesty International appeals. Please feel welcome to join them for some letter writing. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."